Colossians 3:6-3:10. The 11th talk in a series on Colossians was presented by Ron Julian on September 26, 1999, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1999. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Okay. Well, we're going through the book of Colossians together. By my reckoning, this is the 11th time you've had to listen to me talk about this. Let me remind you where we are, try to set the stage for what we're talking about. Now, I admit, and I recognize in your spot, that it's a little bit difficult to follow what's happening in a book like this. There are a lot of little details, a lot of little statements that this one kind of points in this direction, and this one points in this direction, and we go away for a week, and then we come back and try to pick it up again. It may seem like it's a lot of scattered little pieces. What I'm trying to do is, as best I can, try to understand the coherent picture that ties the letter together and try to explain that to you. So I hope that's coming across somewhat. I know it's a difficult job to try to look at the details and yet give the big picture at the same time. As I see it, first of all, I have to remind you that Paul is writing into a situation where the Colossians have been listening to teachers who have been telling them some bad stuff. There is a set of teachers who are telling them things about keeping religious rituals. The essence of spirituality is to be found in not eating certain things, not drinking certain things, keeping certain festivals, and so on. He's been mounting kind of a two-pronged attack on this. On the one hand, he's talking about what it is that's wrong with that perspective, why it is that that is not the essence of spirituality. And then on the other side, he's been talking about the gospel and why it is essential, why it is so important that they not abandon the gospel for this inferior way of coming to God, highly inferior way of coming to God. The bad teaching Paul has called the traditions of men. It seems to make sense by a certain worldly sort of reckoning that God wants us to show our spirituality and devotion by certain outward signs of self-denial. I'm going to limit myself to eating and drinking certain things. I'm going to come to certain days where I'm going to not let myself do certain things and force myself to do other things that I might not otherwise do. That the religious life, the ascetic life, the life of self-denial is the way of showing that I belong to God. But as Paul has been arguing, the problem with this is that it really doesn't solve the human dilemma. First of all, I am a sinner who is under the wrath of God. And I can stop eating or start eating or go to whatever festivals or observe whatever Sabbaths, and it doesn't really solve the problem. I'm still going to be standing one day before my judge, and I'm going to find condemnation before him because I'm an evil person. And all of the eating and drinking or not eating and drinking in the world is not going to solve that problem. And secondly, such observances don't really solve the reality of the problem of sin. It doesn't deal with my guilt, and it doesn't do anything to really take away the problem either. I'm still left being a person of the flesh, a person who is given over to selfishness and rebellion against God. That's the kind of person I am, and the eating and the drinking and all of that hasn't really gotten to the heart of it. Conversely, then, Paul has been arguing that the gospel is profoundly true and profoundly important because it does deal with the most fundamental problem of the human situation. The cross of Christ alone can deal with the problem of my guilt. He paints this very striking picture of my transgressions, the charges against me being nailed to the cross, that I have been delivered from my guilt. I have been justified. I have been declared innocent. And nothing else can do it. And the gospel introduces us into a situation where the reality of sin can be dealt with really, substantially, and ultimately taken away altogether. Now, part of what we have to understand in this book is the picture that Paul is trying to set out about how it is that the gospel impacts my sinfulness in this world, the fact that I'm a sinner. What does the fact that the gospel is true and that I believe the gospel have to do with the nature of the way I live my life? Because that's the section that we're heading into, is a profound set of exhortations from Paul about how we ought to be living. But there's this connection. He's been arguing that it is belief in the gospel. It is embracing and holding on to Christ and what he did that leads to this way of living. So why is that? What is the connection? And as best I can understand, Paul sees three different but interrelated ways in which the gospel has an impact on the way I live my life. First of all, or at least one of them, is that the gospel tells me the ultimate outcome of human existence. The gospel is the story of God's working in the world. I didn't know what creation was all about. I didn't know what human existence was all about, but now I do. I know this story about what God is doing to restore his creation to righteousness, to holiness, to fulfillment, to completion. Jesus is going to return and rule over all of creation. And everything in creation will be subject to the rule of God. All sin will be gone. He will wipe every tear from their eye. I mean, that is the end of the story, or in a sense, the beginning of the story. That's where this age is headed. If I don't know that, I don't understand the life that I'm living day to day. If I'm on a train that is heading for a section of track where that has been blown away and I'm about to descend into a canyon, that makes a huge difference. I mean, I can do whatever I want on the train. I can play cards, or I can read a book, or I can watch a movie, or get married, or, you know, pick it. But the fact is, I'd like to know that this story is headed, you know, off the edge of the cliff. It makes a difference. Where it's headed makes a difference. It always does. Well, I know something about the ultimate outcome of my life and your life and all of creation. And that ultimate outcome has everything to do with the solution of the problem of sin. Jesus is coming to cleanse his people from sin, to make the world a place where sin has no hold anymore. So first of all, the gospel is this story that tells me how concerned God is about the problem of sin in the world and what he's going to do about it. It tells me that my great hope is that sin and its corollaries, death and futility, all of that is going to be eradicated. And for the one who will choose to find his home there, that can be mine. That can be my destiny. So first of all, it tells me about this hope that I have and what that says about sin, what God thinks about sin. Is sin a valuable thing? No. In fact, it's such an enemy of mine that the whole purpose of God's working is to forgive me for sin and to cleanse me of it. That's what he's up to. Okay. Now, secondly then, because the gospel tells me the ultimate goal, it tells me the story and where this is all headed, It gives me perspective on life today. I come into this world thinking that this world is all that I've got to work with. I mean, whether I have religious beliefs or not, in essence, I have this deep-seated belief that this world is all I've got to work with, and that I had better make my place in it as best I can. And if that means lusting after whatever this world can offer me in terms of security and pleasure and all of that, well, I'm going to do it, because what else am I going to find? Where else am I going to go? And if you're in my way, then I'd better do something to get you out of my way, because you're robbing me of the only shot at life that I've got. But I understand differently now. I've been told the end of the story. I know the good that is at the heart of real life. I know what this is supposed to look like now. So I can't look at my own greed and selfishness and lack of love for my neighbor and lack of love for God. I can't look at those things and say, yeah, that's what I want. That's where life is to be found. That's going to get me what I'm looking for. Because if the gospel is starting to take hold in my thinking, then I understand that that's not true. Now, you understand, I'm not saying that I've solved the problem of sin or that I'm not a sinner anymore. But I know something now that I didn't used to know. I know that sin is my enemy. I know that my great hope is that it's going to be defeated. And so, ultimately, it's got no place in my life now. Sure, I give it a place all the time, but I'm fighting it. And why do I fight it? Because I know it is my enemy. It is not what I want. So secondly, the gospel gives me perspective on my life today in light of what I know about where the future is going, so that I am learning to walk away from that which is death and walk towards that which is life. And then thirdly, the gospel has the power to have this impact on my life, because the grace of God is at work in my life through His Spirit. Why should I pay attention to the truth any more today than I did in the past? And what's different now? Well, part of what's different, the most fundamental thing that is different, is the Spirit of God is at work bringing the light to me. It's coming home to me. This is what life is about. God is at work recreating me. And you can tell that He's at work doing that. We can look at each other and see this work of recreation that God is doing. Again, is it that we're not sinners? No. There's not a single one of you here that if I look carefully, I'm going to see regrettable things about you. And you're going to see regrettable things about me. Evil things. I'm not denying that for a second. But there's this other thing happening. We're starting to get it. We're starting to understand where life is to be found. Because the gospel has told us, but it's not just some intellectual theory, I hope. It is coming home to me that that's reality. That's the way it is. So thirdly, the gospel is a powerful message that has an impact on the way I'm living now. It tells me about the future, gives me perspective on today, and the dynamic, the energy that is driving that process is the power of God Himself. It is the power that formed the universe, the power that put the stars in their places, is the power at work in me. That's what Paul says. Okay, so that's what I see as being the topic of discussion. That's from various angles and in various ways. This is what Paul is trying to get at. On the one hand, the inadequacy of the heretical teaching that they've been listening to, and on the other hand, the power of the gospel and the implications of the gospel for their lives today. Right now, the Colossians are facing the question, what am I going to do with the gospel? I heard it before and I believed it, but now that I've been at this for a while, now that I understand some of the implications of it, do I believe it now? Do I want it now? Or have I decided that this other ascetic religion is much more attractive. I like that a lot better. Is the gospel still the picture of the world that I embrace? And Paul is urging them to continue to embrace it. Now, we started talking about chapter 3, verse 5 last week. We didn't get very far. Paul says, therefore, put to death the members on the earth, literally, he says, immorality, impurity, lust, evil passion, and greed, which is idolatry. And as we talked about, Paul sees the false religion that is being proposed in Colossae as being essentially worldly. It is about this world. To think that I have accomplished anything significant by abstaining from eating this particular food is to put all of my emphasis on this world, the things of this world. Not just the fact that it's food, stuff that disappears. You know, this is not stuff that lasts. But also because the rewards I'm looking for are all in this world. I get to think of myself as a religious person. I get to have that secret satisfaction when everybody watches me abstaining, you know, to that little spark of self-satisfaction that says, yeah, I am a little better than those guys, aren't I? All of that is the kind of payback that you get here and now. It has no perspective that says the goal of life, the end and purpose of life, is to find justification and washing from sin and the life that will come when Jesus returns to establish his kingdom. It's not thinking that way. It's when we recognize that my life here and now is not what life is ultimately about. I'm a fool to get attached to anything of this earth because it's going to fail me in the end. Then I start to understand in a more profound way the moral implications of how I deal with the things in this world. Whether I eat meat or vegetables or not is a relatively minor question. It may have some impact on my health to a certain degree, but basically, it has no religious significance. But am I willing to see that when my desires tell me that I should take any woman I want at any time, that I have bought a lie that this world is selling me? When my desires tell me that I have to have all the material possessions I can get my hands on because that's where security is to be found, that's where pleasure and power and status is to be found, that I am embracing goods that are not good. Ultimately, that stuff isn't worth anything. Not in the light of who God is, of what he values, and where he's taking the world. When I understand what the real story is about, then those things become very earthly, worldly. That's just this stuff. But the story is about a lot more than just this stuff. That's why he calls greed idolatry. It's that lie that says that God is not enough. That ultimately, the bottom line is, I have to have some other god protect me. Maybe it's the god of mammon, of wealth, that's going to give me security and prestige and pleasure in this world. That's the God that you really have to bow down to. Sure, you know, God, you know, he's off up there somewhere, and I go to church and talk about God, and I believe in God, and that's great, but he's kind of irrelevant, isn't he? I mean, he's way off there somewhere. But you mess around with money, you get money mad at you in this world, and now you're talking serious trouble. Right? Because now I experience right away, I know immediately what the wrath of mammon is like. I don't want to mess around with that. It's powerful. I mean, I hope you understand, I'm talking straightforwardly. I recognize the power of it. I want stuff. I want the security that comes with stuff. It makes sense, right? I mean, it's so immediate. I get immediate feedback on the pluses and minuses of money. But what Paul is saying is, if the gospel is true, then there's something bigger than that. And to pretend that there isn't something bigger than that is to be an idolater. I have put something else in the place of the ultimate reality, God. What's the ultimate reality? Money. That's the ultimate reality. What's the ultimate reality? Pleasure. Sensual gratification. That's the ultimate reality. Well, it's not. And today, here and now, is the time when we have to wrestle with those questions. What is the big deal? What is the bottom line? What is the reality that you can't get past? That's what Paul is starting to talk to them about. Their self-righteous, ascetic approach to religion has not really brought them to confront the essence of the problem. What is the real story here? What am I facing? So, that's where we are. Now let's continue on. He said, we saw in 3:5, put to death the members of your earthly body. So in 6, for it is on account of these things that the wrath of God will come, and in them you also once walked when you were living in them. He's reminding them that their former devotion to the things of this world, sensual pleasure and the material possessions, that at that time they were under the wrath of God. It is the wrath of God that is going to come upon the world because of things like that. Our selfish preoccupation with our own material gratification. I don't want to look at God, and I don't really want to look at you, because you can get in the way of that too. He's saying, remember. Remember, you know the end of the story. What is the outcome of that in the end? Where does it get you? You're turning away from truth. You're turning away from what is valuable and what is good. What's it going to get you? I'll tell you what it would get you. It would get you the wrath of God. The coming wrath of God. The final, complete, and total, irreversible wrath of God. Now, why is Paul telling them this? Why does he want them to think about this? It's a tough thing to think about. As Christians, I think it's a hard thing for us to think about the wrath of God, because I still feel very vulnerable. I mean, I'm a sinner. You can't tell me to remember that the wrath of God comes on those who practice such things, and I start shaking, because, man, that's me. That's where I belong. Isn't it true that I have been forgiven through what Christ did? Isn't it true that the wrath of God is something that is not my destiny? And yes, if I'm a believer, absolutely that's true. Nonetheless, he still wants me to remember that the wrath of God comes upon the evil in this world, because it gives me perspective. It tells me what God thinks above all. What does God think about sin? What does God think about the many ways in which I have devoted myself to lies and sensual gratification and material gratification in ways that I have denied the truth about reality? What does he think about that? He's thinking, oh, you guys, what am I going to do with you? You know, kind of comes along and hits us up next to the side of the head and says, come on, straighten up. No, this is pow, zap, toast. I mean, this is, no. This is not just a mistake. This is a fundamental evil. That's what God thinks. That's what the destiny in the end of humanity is, of all that have not found reconciliation with God. That's where it's going. So, I can't pretend that sin is no big deal anymore. When I was hiding from God, I could, but I can't think about sin and think of it as, well, you know, it's just human nature. Or something like that. I can't think about it that way anymore. The wrath of God is coming, and that's what its target is. And he he reminds them that there was a time when they walked in those things. That is, they embraced them. They thought it was good. Looking out for number one, that's the thing to do, right? I mean, everybody does that. If you've got to stab a few people in the back to make sure you're doing okay, well, that's just the way things are, right? But when I was thinking that way, I realize now, I was just out and out wrong. I didn't understand the way things are, but now I do. Now, okay, now let's go on to the next thing he says. But now you also put all these things aside: wrath, rage, malice, slander, foul language from your mouth. Do not lie to one another. And I'm going to stop there, kind of in the middle of the sentence. The second list now, the first dealt with desire. Sensual desire, the desire for material things in this world. The second list has to do with the way we relate to each other, and in particular with the way we use our mouths, the things we say to each other. Obviously, there's a relationship between the evils that I perpetrate on you and the desires that he talked about above. I want life to be a certain way, and when it isn't, and I feel you're responsible, then my response is wrath and rage and slander and all of those kind of things. I mean, most people are not evil in their behavior towards other people just for kicks. I mean, I can enjoy treating other people well. I can enjoy the feeling of satisfaction that comes when I can think of myself as being a kind and generous person. It's only when you get in my way, it's only when I have to pay the price, that it only makes sense. Well, of course, you don't expect me to be kind to a person who'd do a thing like that. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. It all has its roots in a wrong perspective of the world, of myself. What's valuable? Who am I? Who are you? Who is God? And Paul includes in this list lying to one another. The Bible puts a profound value on truth. It's actually one of the great perversions of humanity, I think, that we lie so much. Why do we do it? Well, I want life to be a certain way. And if I can't get it, one of the ways I can bring it about is to manipulate you by feeding you wrong information. Things are one way, but I'm going to tell you it's another way, because I can benefit from that. The truth is hard. The truth is uncomfortable. I don't want to have to live with it. If I can turn the truth into something else and make you believe it, my life becomes a lot easier. Well, the gospel comes along and tells me the end of the story, tells me what this is all about. It tells me about a God who has created me with the same worth and dignity as he created you. So first of all, the gospel reminds me of the great ethical principles that underlie reality. When Jesus is asked, what are the great commandments? Love God and love your neighbor. My neighbor, that human being who is just as worthy of consideration as I am. That's the truth. That's the God I serve. That's the reality in which I live. As much as I have this instinct that says I am more important than everyone else, it's not true. And if I have come to believe the gospel, then I'm starting to see that that's not true. The gospel tells me Jesus is hanging on the cross because you have been living a lie, thinking that you are more important than anyone else. It's not so. Furthermore, there is that unique relationship that I have with you folks, and that you have with me. We have with each other. We share a common destiny. We share a common set of beliefs. I think that you are with me in this journey. My life is a journey, your life is a journey, and we're headed for the same place. If that's true, and if I think of my life in that way, then you are my companions. You and I are in this together. And so again, you ought to mean something to me if the gospel is true. If the gospel is true, you ought to mean something to me as a human being, and you ought to mean something to me as my brother and sister. Both of those things are true if the gospel is true. Okay, let me say what I was going to say a little later on. Let me say it now to make clear the sort of thing that I'm getting at. Why is Paul saying this stuff to them? I mean, this is, you know, I realize for the last several weeks here, my talk has been very much, an exhortation, cut it out. This is the way you ought to be doing things. This is the way you ought to be thinking about things. I mean, this is what Paul's doing, right? I mean, I'm not telling you anything different than what he's saying. But why is he doing it? What's his purpose? What's at stake for him? There are those, as I mentioned last week, who have seen the teaching that Paul gives here as essentially showing us how to arrive at a higher level of Christianity. That I can go beyond merely being saved by faith, and I can, as we're about to see, put on the new man, which is this act of faith that I do. Yes, I'm going to heaven. Yes, I'm saved. But I reach out and I appropriate the power of the new man in some way. And now I have a new power to avoid sin and do what's right. Some see this section as being about that. But it's not, I would argue. What we've been seeing is this is not a letter written to Christians showing them how to arrive at a higher level. This is a letter written to people who started out believing the gospel, but Paul knows that some of them have started listening to something that is not the gospel at all. This is all a part of his exhortation to hold fast to Christ, to not walk away from the gospel. This is all a part of his exhortation to them not to abandon the faith. And I would argue that when he is giving this exhortation about putting on the new man and putting to death the member, your earthly members, walking away from sensuality and greed and malice and lying and things like that, that this is not some super secret that only a few Christians arrive at, nor is it just good advice. You know, now that you've been saved, I think you'll find that life will go a lot better if you're nicer to people or something. That's not it either. This is Paul's way of confronting them with the issues that the gospel represents to them now. Yes, they believed the story about Jesus, but now they've heard this other thing. They've heard that spirituality is to be found in eating and drinking in a certain way. What Paul is saying is, no, don't walk away from the gospel. Remember, what does the gospel tell you? You died with Christ. That is, you have a new relationship to this world. You have been forgiven for your sins, if you are in fact a believer. And you have a hope to be freed from sin altogether. And you have an understanding now. Hopefully that's growing. This book talks a lot about God teaching us and us learning to understand what God is all about, to understand what God values. I am in a position now where I am starting to understand what's important. So, it is the process. They're at a crossroad. They can turn away from the implications of the real gospel and content themselves with sacrificial eating and drinking. I don't drink that anymore. Which hasn't really gotten to the heart of the problem. Or they can remember what it is the gospel really says, and they can start bit by bit to see the implications of that for their life. If the gospel is true, then how can I think that gratifying my sensual desires is the highest priority? How can I think that material possessions are the highest priority? How can I think that my grudge against whoever has crossed me is the highest priority? How can I think that getting my own way is such a priority that I would distort the truth to get it? When I do those things, and I do them because I'm a sinner, but when I do them, I am living a lie. I am living as if the gospel were not true. Well, for those of us who, in fact, are children of God, in whom God is at work, that can't be a settled issue. I can't just continue to live as if the gospel weren't true. Somewhere along the line, God is going to push at me and say, yeah, but what about this? The way Paul is pushing at the Colossians in this letter. What about this? Isn't this, in fact, what's true? Isn't this, in fact, what life is about? And if it is, then you've got to take the next step, right? You've got to do what makes sense with the reality that you believe is there. If reality is like this, then what are you doing over here? This is the way it is. That's what Paul is doing. I would argue that Paul is not a perfectionist. He doesn't believe that Christians arrive at perfect obedience in this life. He's not saying that I'm going to somehow prove that I'm a believer by getting out and doing a bunch of good deeds or something like that. What he's saying is, what those teachers are telling you is a lie. And the way of life that you have embraced has missed the point. The gospel is true. Being reconciled to God through the cross is the only way to find life. Life consists of being freed from sin. That is my destiny. And so, that being the case, what does a knowledge of God produce in my life? The more I come to know that God is about those things, that He's doing those things, the more that that's true, what are the stars that I steer by? It's like I've moved from the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere, and I have a different set of stars to steer by now. Paul's saying you're steering by the wrong set of stars. You say you're a southern hemisphere kind of guy, but you always seem to be steering by those other stars. It doesn't make any sense. Don't you believe the stuff that you say you believe? So, that's what Paul's doing. That's what I understand him to be doing in this section. His exhortations are meant to confront them and us with the implications of what we believe, so that as we confront these kinds of issues in various ways, in personal ways, in our own lives, we see what's at stake. Sure, we make a lot of mistakes. We fall down. We're selfish when we shouldn't be. We pursue things that weren't worth pursuing. I mean, it happens. But what do I do with it? What do I think about it? What do I think when I hear Paul saying, you know, this stuff's all going to burn. What's it going to do for you in the end? What do I think about that? What light does that shine on the decisions I've been making? So, you can see why we in the church have wrestled, I think, with the kind of teaching that Paul's giving here, because we tend to want to make it really, really simple on one side or the other. We have those who would basically want to emphasize, look what Paul's saying here, to such an extent that they would say that you're not saved unless you are substantially, and some would even say perfectly, keeping everything that Paul's talking about here. That's why Paul's saying it. You want to know whether you're a Christian or not? Have you ever been greedy? You have? Then you're not. Cut it out. That's one side of the question. Or the other side is to say, no, but look, this is a gospel of grace. We've been forgiven for our sins. He can't mean that our salvation is dependent on this stuff. This has to be some extra stuff that he brings along. And so we've got these two choices. It's extra optional stuff that I can do for some extra blessing, or you have to do it all perfectly or you're not saved. And those are the two camps that are constantly arguing with each other throughout the course of Christian history. Well, what I'm trying to say is that not that the middle is always the right place, but what I'm saying is it's kind of in the middle. it's not that you have to do all of this perfectly, but at the same time, you cannot be indifferent to the truth and be confident that you belong to God. You can't look at what Paul is saying here and say, I don't buy it. That's not the way I want to live my life. You can't do that and have the confidence that you are a person who has embraced the gospel, because the gospel ultimately is all about that stuff. It's telling me life is headed here. And if I live as if life is not headed here, then what do I mean when I say I believe it? Sure, I make foolish choices along the way because I still struggle with my own innate selfishness. I know that's true. But even then, what do I do with that? Do I look at my failures in life in the light of where I'm headed or not? Do I look at it and say, that's not what I want. That's not what I ought to be about, because life is headed over here. That's the kind of exhortation that Paul is giving. What he's saying is, these kinds of ethical issues, you know, how I conduct myself sexually, how I deal with material possessions, how I deal with other human beings in lying and or not lying, telling the truth, being forbearing or vindictive, all of those kinds of things. It is in those places where I don't just confront an ethical question, I confront an eschatological one. I confront the question is, where is this story going? Where is life headed? What is it all about? I think it's a good thing that in our culture there are those who are arguing that what they would call the Judeo-Christian ethical system ought to have influence in our cultural life. That without some guideline about right and wrong, that we have a tendency to go far astray, and I think that's true. But the essence of the gospel is not having the Ten Commandments hanging on schoolroom walls, because there's something missing there. Because the important part is, ultimately, what gives the Ten Commandments force, and we would have to talk about what sort of thing the Ten Commandments are, but let's just talk about the ethical side of God, the picture of loving God and loving your neighbor that we find in the Bible. It's not just a set of precepts. It's not just something that says society works better when you live this way. It is a statement about ultimate reality. God is there. He is good. You are not. You need to be forgiven. You need to be rescued from your innate evil. That's the reality. And it's when I have taken those things in now that my ethical decisions start to have real force. Now, my decision to try to fight my own evil sensual indulgences or my own evil materialism or something like that. It's not just a legalism. It's not just, oh, I'm going to try to do what's right so I can think I'm a good guy or something like that. It is me confronting the question, what do I think is true? What do I think life is about? And as I confront those questions, they start to have an impact on the way I do things. Does that make sense? What I'm saying, I'm looking for feedback here. Does that make sense? The options I'm setting out for you, the picture I'm trying to paint here? Somebody say something to me. Does it not make sense to somebody? Can I say something that will help make it clearer? Nobody wants to admit it. That's all right. See, the key here, what I'm trying to get across is, this is not just, I'm not just here to say, look, you know, quit fooling around, quit buying so much stuff, quit being angry with people. I mean, it's not just that. Because, okay, I mean, you know, you can get advice on how to live life from everywhere. You know, there's a ton of books that'll tell you how life will go better if you do this. And, you know, how many people have taught on things like the Ten Commandments and the the Beatitudes and things like that, as if they were God's teaching on how to be happy. I think, right, there was one teacher who wrote a book on the Beatitudes called The Be Happy Attitudes. And that was the teaching, that was the idea, was if you do these things, you know, be meek, be poor in spirit and all that stuff, and you'll be a lot happier. That's not the point. That's not what it's about. The issue is, what is true? What do you think life is about? Every single human being is a philosopher. A dirty word, but in our culture, but the fact is we all have a philosophy of life. Everyone, whether they know it or not, has answered for themselves or is asking questions about ultimate reality. What is reality? What is this world I'm living in? Where is the good life to be found? Paul is saying that the gospel, in essence, is a fully developed philosophy of life, rooted in a picture of what is real. God is ultimately real. Goodness is ultimately real. Fulfillment is found in reconciliation with God and restoration to what human life is meant to be. This is a philosophy of life. This is what's true. And because I think it's true, then I am pursuing the things that are related to that. That's what Paul's getting at. He's telling them, you have the wrong philosophy of life, or at least you're toying with the wrong philosophy of life. Because those things aren't true, and the gospel is true. And so let me tell you some of the places where the gospel is going to rub against your wrong perspective of life. It's going to rub on you when you think about, what should I do with my body in this world? It's going to rub on you when you think about, what should I do about material possessions in this world? And what should I do about other people when they bug me? And what should I do when I could easily get what I want if I lied about it? It's those places where the reality of the gospel is going to rub against my false picture of the world. Which of them is going to win ultimately? That's the issue. Okay. So, that's always my concern. That's what I understand Paul's concern to be. Notice, I'll talk a little more about this next time, but when he talks about having put off the old man with his evil practices and having put on the new, the one being remade unto a knowledge in accordance with the image of his Creator. What is it about this new man? What is it that's new about me? I'm being renewed to a new knowledge. I know things the way God knows them. I understand life more and more the way God understands it. That's what's new. I get it in a way that I didn't get it before. That's at the heart of all true reform, is to change my mind, first of all. What is it that I think is true? And from that flows everything else. Okay, well, let's take a few minutes for questions. And
I have two questions. One is, what does filthy language from your lips mean in terms of in verse 8? Right. How would you define that?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure. That's a question I had, too. Well, that's part of the question. I would assume, here's my thinking so far. I mean, related to the way they translate it, abusive language. The issue throughout in this list seems to have to do with the way we interact with each other. So as opposed to a list that says, you know, don't drink, don't cuss, you know, that kind of list, that this seems to be a variety of ways of describing, you know, I've got anger, malice, slander. It's these various ways of expressing my hostility toward someone else. And if that's the case, then New American Standard may be on the right track. Was it NASB? With the abusive language idea, the idea being that it's foul language, but it's language that is ugly. The heart of its ugliness is not that it's scatological or something like that, but that it's invective. You know, it's intended to tear you down or something like that. So I think that's probably right, but I'm not totally sure.
And the other question I have is, you know, I see myself having some of these bad things, and it talks about putting to death and getting rid of that, but obviously being aware of your problem is one step,
right?
And asking God for help is the second step, but then how does one
right.
do that, Ron?
Right. In my next book, 32 steps to, well, see, what I understand Paul to be saying, when he says put to death these things, I do not believe that he means there is a technique by which you can eradicate these things from your life, and so use that technique. Remember what the alternative is. The alternative is a group of people who have turned away from these issues and think that they're great with God because they're not eating meat or something like that. What he's saying is, look, your life is with Christ. Christ died to rescue you. And that rescue is in the process of working itself out now, but ultimately it is coming. Your real life awaits to be revealed when he comes and makes all things new. That's what your life is about. So that being the case now, what sort of attitude are you going to take to this world? So as best I would understand the technique that Paul is advocating here, you're doing what he's advocating. You are being, I don't mean to put myself in a position of importance here, but the fact that we're together talking about what's true and the implications of that truth, that's what putting to death these earthly things looks like, I think. I am continually reminding myself of the gospel. I'm personally embracing it as much as I can. Yes, this is true. This is what I want. And so when I get out there again, you know, I go out there for another round this week, and I face into the question, what do I want? There are struggles in my life, struggles related to all of the categories that Paul talks about here. Pick all of those categories, and I can show you aspects of my life that I have struggled with for as long as I have been a believer. And the trend seems to look like I'm going to struggle with them for the rest of my life. I don't think that I'm ever going to come to the place where I can say, that's a done deal. And yet, as I understand what Paul's talking about, I believe that I am a person that is seeing my life as being with Christ and putting to death my earthly members. I am teaching myself what is true and listening to others talk about what is true. I'm embracing that truth. I'm reminding myself of those truths as I'm in the middle of the situations of my life. Sometimes I'm strong and thinking about what I hold dear in the gospel has a great power and influences the way I conduct myself with other people or with myself. Sometimes I am weak, and as much as I know that reality is a certain way, at the moment I don't want to be reminded and you know, I'm ticked off and I'm going to give vent to it. And I can almost feel this part of me inside that's kind of been locked up and saying, this is not right. This is not the way it ought to be. But I've just kind of shoved it aside. Well, I think that's the reality of our situation, and I don't think that Paul sees it as any different. That's why he needs to make exhortations like this. But it starts with my perspective. To put it to death means, this is not my life. This is not what my life is about. My life is hidden with Christ. That's what my life is. Now, fallible, weak, foolish me is going to go out there and live my life, but I know that my life is about that. And I'm going to keep living that life, trying to live it more and more in the light of the truth that I know. Ultimately, I'm going to abandon that truth if it doesn't mean anything to me because it's going to be too inconvenient. Or else that truth is going to catch hold and I can see it catching hold. I mean, that's what I understand Paul to be talking about. That question that you asked, you know, you say, you know, Ron, you know, tell us how to do this. You understand? From almost the moment I became a Christian, the question that I asked everyone I knew was, how do you do this? You know, I read Paul saying, walk by the Spirit and you will not fulfill the desires of the flesh. Great! How do you do that? I went to every Christian that I thought knew anything about anything and said, what does that mean? How do you do that? Because it sounded like it was a technique. It sounded like he was saying, here's the key. The reason you have been screwing up is because you haven't been walking by the Spirit. But walk by the Spirit, and now the problem will be solved. I have come to believe, the more I look at those things, that that's not the reason Paul said them. He was not giving a technique. In all of those places, he was confronting the choice between belief and unbelief. Is the gospel true or isn't it? And that, it is by making that choice, by embracing that choice personally, that I walk by the Spirit, that I put to death the deeds of the flesh and all of that stuff. That's what I understand right now. Okay, we head over here.
Would another way to put it be that in verse 5, how it ends after saying, therefore consider the members of your earthly body as dead, or I guess some versions say, put to death these things.
More literally, that's what he says.
Right. Yeah. At the end, it says, which amounts to idolatry. Another way to think about it, this is helpful to me, but I just want to see if it's accurate, be that I no longer see those things as not as my salvation. They have no salvation for me. I may, in the moment, grab up that sword of making myself feel big by feeling hatred, and therefore I'm not so scared, but I'm at the point that I realize that that will not save me, that there is no life in it for me. So they are dead to me as a way of salvation. I'm at a certain level, a profound level, convinced that they will not save me. I keep kind of grabbing them in the moment to do, to protect myself and kind of think that they're going to work. But more and more, because I'm becoming more and more convinced that they will not save me, they're dead to me. They don't have what I need. And more I see that.
Yeah, I like that. That's very good. Because see what. That's the emphasis that I'm trying to get started here. It starts with my perception of the value of these things and what's real, what's going on. Those things don't immediately translate into a perfect application of those truths in every time I do anything, because I'm still struggling with my own sinfulness. And as you say, at the moment I can, or even upon some consideration, I can grab for something that at the moment seems like I just got to have it. But there's this perspective behind that is coming to have more and more influence on my thinking. That, yeah, just as you say, this is not my salvation. At one time I would have thought, this is essential. I have to have this. But now I know, no. This is not essential. What I have to have is the forgiveness that Christ brings on the cross and the life that comes from that. That's what I have to have. This other stuff is, I see it in a different light, and that's where it starts. The word perspective is very important, I think, you know, biblical perspective.
Really quickly, I just want to, when I say in the moment, I don't want to suggest that I only do that in the moment. There are things that I cling to with a death grip and say, God, help me get my fingers off.
Right.
But I'm clinging to a lot of those.
Right. Yeah. No, I understand. But I did want to emphasize that. I don't want anybody to get scared and think, oh, my gosh, I don't just, you know, sometimes I sin after thinking about it. I must be headed for hell. Well, you would be. I mean, you deserve to be. But the fact is that that sin is like that. I mean, it's not that wrestling with what I know to be true and my own self. That's a big part of this process. Okay, Stan, you had your hand up.
Because on a couple of occasions Paul has referred to the other teachers, I would like to know if you agree with the fact that he's not only referring to Judaizers, but even maybe more so to other forms of idolatry at the time. Paul is a teacher of Gentiles, and the age that's been going on has been going on for centuries at this time. The newness of Christianity is only 30 years. And indeed, Paul's taken this opportunity to teach the idolaters of the New Age, just as we would experience it today, of the newness and freshness and the truth of Christianity.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. It's tricky, as I mentioned to you before, Stan. There is a tricky aspect to Colossians. Paul doesn't go into the detail in Colossians that he does in Galatians about what the nature of the problem is that he's addressing, so we kind of have to piece it together. I think there is a Jewish element to it, but I would agree with you that I think in Colossae, the Gentiles there, to the extent that they would find an ascetic sort of approach to God, that would make sense to them, it would be because of, not because they were Jews who were obviously through training had put a certain value on eating kosher and that kind of stuff, but because of other religious influences that would have a similar feel to them. So there is a, I see in Paul him taking the ritual aspects of Judaism and really lumping them together with the ritual aspects of all of the religious expressions of man and putting that whole package, seeing that as kind of the kindergarten stuff, the elementary school stuff. Some of the Gutenberg students came over the other night and we watched a film which is, it's all just images, and many of the images in it are of various religious ceremonies throughout the world. Quick cutting between one and the other, making a very definite sort of statement that, you know, they're all the same, really. You know, you can see the similarity between them. Everybody has their own, you know, this person's kissing this rock over here, and this person is kissing this thing over here, and these people are bowing over here, and these people are bowing over here, and all that sort of thing. And what struck me when I was watching it was what Paul says about the elemental things. That yes, there is a great similarity between all the religions of the world, but the things that make them similar are not at the heart of what a relationship with God is about. It's not those things. That doesn't mean that all religions are the same. What it means is that all the religious expressions that men come up with tend to look the same, but the question is, what are you going to do with the big question of my guilt, my relationship to my creator and judge? So, yeah, I think it is important to recognize that there is a Gentile element to what Paul's talking about, to the problem, as best we can understand it. Although I think there is a Jewish aspect to it as well, as best I can see.
Mm-hmm. What you've just commented on makes me even more comfortable with the fact that we have it's a universal sinfulness. It's a universal problem we all have.
Right.
And your description of the film that you saw simply was one of representation of man and man's weakness, and he chooses lots of different idolatries. Well, it seems very appropriate to me to even today think, as I have the same background as Margaret, the ritual of Catholicism, and just compare that to the ritual of New Age. They're both going on today, and they're both weaknesses I can fall into, and I'm listening to Paul with reference to both aspects of my weakness to go in either direction. But Paul's saying, hold it, Stan. Listen to the real meaning.
Yeah. And I want to emphasize that Protestants are just as capable of empty ritual as any other religious group in the world. So it's not... The question is whether I have mistaken the shadow for the substance. And I can do that in Christianity, Protestant Christianity, as much as I can in anything else. Okay, we've really run out of time, so I've got to stop.